This week on Pop of Culture, we try to plug the brain drain.
Because for some reason, people go through school and then go, well, the only place to make a living doing this is on one of the coasts. Let's leave.
Lessons from a professional theater in Michigan.
And what happens when Black teens sit down with their elders? A new documentary shows us.
It was really phenomenal listening to those stories of people who'd been waiting to tell them, honestly.
Coming up.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Coming up this hour, we head to a swing state.
Don't worry, we won't break down polling numbers.
But we will talk about starting artistic conversations where neighbors disagree.
Before that, let's go to Anderson. Joining me is Maria Ignatz Alexander, and she's going to tell us all about a very special movie screening that's happening on October 19th. Maria, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I love the whole idea behind this film. I'm going to let you explain it because I certainly would not do it justice. So tell us about what will be happening this weekend, Maria.
Well, I'll kind of give you the shortest version of the story I can. As short versions go, it started several years ago. Mm-hmm. We had a group in Madison County, standing up for racial equity about 4 years ago, say, we'd love to do some sort of multimedia project featuring Black history in our community. Then last year, in 2023, I worked with a group called More and Diverse Voices in Madison County specifically, and we went around to a bunch of different school organizations and other organizations that had youth in them, asking them what was important to them about the community, what did they feel was lacking, what did they want their community to know about what they needed.
Sure.
And it kind of broke my heart because one of the gentlemen at our table, he was about 16, 17-year-old Black male student, said, I don't see people who look like me succeeding in Anderson.
Wow.
And that really bummed me out because I see so many success stories in Anderson in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and said, if you don't know those stories, it's because the adults are not doing a good job teaching you.
Ah,
do you mind if we take this idea and kind of run with it? And he said, yeah, that'd be fine. And then in January of this year, I was at a meeting with Sherry Peake at the Impact Center and Kelly Kelly, who is one of my coordinators at Community Lens of Anderson.
Yes.
And my brain, when Sherry said something, my brain just kind of spun out and got hold of it and just said, hey, what if we did some sort of intergenerational interview community project featuring Black elders in the community talking about their stories? We don't have these elders much longer. I mean, everybody knows every year you lose more and more people with amazing stories.
Yeah.
And so Sherry said, yes, that sounds great. And so between Impact Center, Madison County Sure, and Community Lens of Anderson, we kind of did a very, very bare bones budget operation where I went around to all different schools in the community and a few different groups of youth and just said, hey, if you want to join up with a project over the summer and do this documentary, here's my number, here's a flyer, contact me. We ended up having 8 interviewers and we filmed over 13 hours of footage of interviews with 29 different interview people. At the Impact Center. Yeah, it was incredible. I got to sit in on all of the interviews except for one because I was holding a baby fort for somebody else. But it was really phenomenal listening to those stories of people who'd been waiting to tell them, honestly.
Yeah.
And then we managed to kind of work together and get it edited down into an hour and 20 minutes. We're calling it Black Excellence Resides in Anderson.
Mm.
And we're going to be doing a screening this Saturday from 2 to 4 at the Impact Center, 630 Nickel Avenue in Anderson. And we're going to have a community pigeon lunch. So if people want to bring food in honor of excellence that they remember.
Oh, nice.
But it's just kind of a celebration for everybody to hear how it came to be and all of the Black excellence stories that reside here.
Yeah. And herein lies the awesomeness of the project, Maria, in that you could have had adults just filming the stories of adults in the community, right? But yes. the step of saying we want the teens to be able to do that. So A, they can hear the stories firsthand, they can ask the questions that are on their mind, and they could like real-time impact, right? So talk a little bit about how this impacted the teenagers that set out on this project.
Hugely. I'm so glad we went the extra step to get the kids involved.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons, I feel like there's our generation is seeing more and more gaps with the generation. People aren't going to church the groups or community groups as much where you're going to get an intergenerational crossover. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to provide more contact points for a few reasons. We want them to feel like they belong in the community. We want them to feel like they have support in the community. And to see the teenagers not only grow in confidence through their interviewing skills, we had one teenager who she's 18, very, very quiet. And by the end, she did the last interview and conducted mm-hmm. it herself. And it was like, Maria, I think I want to do it. And so that was cool to see them grow in that way. But also just to see their pride in the community increase exponentially. The fact that so many of these kids, and we had all of the kids except for one was Latina. The rest had some part of Black in their demographics. Mm-hmm. And so for them to see specifically the excellence in the Black community in Anderson, how it's still here, how it was in the past, and what they want it to be was huge. They had so much more pride in knowing they were a part of it. And also hearing back from elders saying, we actually have your back. If you want more support, just let me know. Here's my number if you want a college recommendation. Here's my number if you need to ask questions about this career field. Mm-hmm. Those little micro points are going to make a huge difference in those kids' lives. And also, I think going forward, we're going to be posting it on YouTube for teachers to use in their classrooms well.
Yes.
And we're giving it completely away for free. Mm-hmm. We made it almost free. We're giving it away for free as a gift to the community. But for teachers to be able to say to their students, so we don't have more of what that gentleman said. We have kids who say, actually, did you know that this person did this in my community? Did you know that they came from here and they're still doing cool things here? That I think is value that you can't buy.
Absolutely. It starts those very necessary conversations that need to happen in classrooms, in homes, in, you know, out in the community so that people continue to celebrate contributions and impact in Anderson. I love that. I love that. I have a question. What about the young man who kind of had that original idea? Was he involved in the project?
No, sadly, because of that, the nature of that group, we couldn't, everything was anonymous. So we couldn't follow up with certain members because it was anonymous.
Oh, yes.
And so I know I'm hoping that the word gets out to him.
Me too.
I know. But, you know, sometimes, again, that seeds that you plant somewhere, you don't know where they're going to pop up and grow. You don't know if you're going to see things later on that you had a part in playing that mm-hmm. you didn't know about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without giving too much away, Maria, can you share maybe one story, one interview that you're still thinking about today that it just kind of, it really, you know, gotcha in the feels? Yeah.
Well, I will say I did the editing with my husband and it felt impossible to edit a project. It was my first time editing anything.
Yeah.
And it felt impossible to choose what was important because it all felt so important. So we are going to have the raw interview footage available at the Impact Center for people to see the whole thing.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Just as a side, because these stories were really, really hard to cut back because there's mm-hmm. so much good. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the main things that I heard from people, one gentleman talks about how his great-grandma was a liberated slave. And he tells a story that she would gather around her children and her great-grandchildren and tell the story. And then he later on goes to talk about things that he did in the community and saying she didn't hold on to that as her identity. She kept going. And there's other people who talked about civil rights in the community. There is a man who owned the first Black music store in Anderson.
Wow.
And he talked about how important that was and how many Black businesses in Anderson were that he came from Chicago because they didn't have that.
Wow.
And so I think for kids to see, oh, I didn't realize we had so much Black excellence, past, present, and future. And if you don't know the past, you can't know exactly how much the future can hope for. But also you can't cherish what's going on in the present either while it's still here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said, Maria. And Maria, what is your official title? How did you get involved with the project?
I am a community organizer. I work with both Madison County Sure Standing Up for Racial Equity and Community Lens of Anderson.
Okay.
I call myself the education chair, although I serve several different roles in those groups. And also I just took on a role as the Anderson Education Foundation executive director. So that's kind of my spiel. I connect with this schools as much as I can, but also some community organizations that I really believe in.
Yeah. And now documentary editor and producer. So
yes. We'll see if I do that again, but it was one of the most meaningful things and the most difficult things I've ever done.
Well, I cannot wait to see the result of all of that hard work. Congratulations on the project. I think it's going to be very important for not just those who live in Anderson to watch, but everyone to watch and maybe take a hint from it that we all need to celebrate Black excellence in our communities.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Can't wait to see what grows next. Thanks, Maria. What would it be like to start an arts organization in a small town in a swing state?
We're about to talk to someone who did just that. We are here with Tony Caselli, who's the artistic director of Williamston Theater in Williamston, Michigan, which is right outside of Lansing. And Tony, welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And Tony, you are the artistic director and you are one of the four founders of Williamston Theater, which is a professional company. As I said, we're right outside of Lansing, Michigan. Can you tell us a little bit about the company's history since you're one of the four founders and then also sort of how it's evolved over time?
Sure, absolutely. Started in 2006. It was me and the three other friends of mine who are theater professionals in Michigan, John Leppard and Chris Purchase and Emily Sutton Smith. And the four of us met. I had been working at the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea, Michigan for 12 years. And I was directing John in a show, and we just started talking about the idea of starting another theater wanting to do it in a small town somewhere and what our goals would be and why we would want to do that. And then as we got more and more serious about the idea, we sort of recruited Chris and Emily, who we also knew. Emily was an actor and an administrator in Michigan theater. And Chris was at the time the company manager for the Purple Rose. And we wound up getting together and, you know, meeting in coffee shops and figuring out how we wanted to do this. And that was in 2004. And then by 2006, we were launching into our first full production here in Williamston, in the small town of Williamston, Michigan. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about Williamston and just the idea of a professional theater in a small town seems a little bit oxymoronic if you think about it, but in all the best ways, right? So what was it about this community that made you think that a theater could really work there?
Yeah, no, Williamston itself is small. I want to say the population of Williamston itself is just under 4,000 people. But we're also right along the highway corridor between Lansing and Detroit and Howell and Brighton and a lot of big cities, and so easily accessible to a lot of places. But Williamston itself is a small, sleepy little bedroom community in the middle of farmland. And that's part of what drew us to it. To be honest, working at the Purple Rose, which was founded by Jeff Daniels, the film star and then star, and I was there from early on. I think I started working there in like the second production. And watching what that did for Chelsea, Michigan, which was a small town, was very inspiring. And I grew up in a small town and loved going to the big city to see shows, loved going to New York to see Broadway shows, all of that stuff. But I also really love the value that theater can bring. And the four of us felt strongly that small rural towns, communities, had just as much of a need, and maybe even more of a need for that type of exposure, for that type of collaboration, for that type of culture in their town. And that was one of the big reasons that we started looking around and settled on Williamston. John, the other one of the other founders, had grew up in this area and was back living here, but he was one of Michigan's handful of, you know, professional equity actors. And there is a good, vibrant community of those professional theater makers in Michigan. And so the other reason we started the place was to try and prevent all of that talent drain that pulls people out of states in the Midwest, because for some reason people go through school and then go, well, the only place to make a living doing this is on one of the coasts.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes Chicago, but Chicago's tough too. So I think you're absolutely right in that a lot of folks, when they want to do this professionally and make art professionally, they don't even think to look around in the communities where they currently find themselves, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And that was really one of our goals. I think at last count, there are maybe 9 year-round professional equity regional theaters in Michigan. And so, you know, if you're familiar with Michigan, the state looks like a mitten, right? That's our joke.
Yeah.
And so we always joke that, like, you know, the theater district of the state is the whole mitten. There's no, you know, and so it's always funny because it's not like going to New York and going, oh, well, the theater district's here, or, you know, well, over here is where the theaters gather. No, it's all over, and trying to keep people in the state was important to us. So, yeah, we just opened season 18, and a lot of that is, you know, deliberately in order to continue spreading the word that theater can exist and should exist in small towns, and also to create work for people, you know, make the world a better place through storytelling. That's our goal.
Absolutely. And that's excellent. And obviously something's working because you are in your 18th season. Yeah.
Yeah, so far so good. We've had, you know, like most companies, ups and downs. But that whole pandemic thing was a little discouraging.
Of course.
But coming back from it, we've managed to claw back. Like most of the theater industry, it still feels like we're trying to get back to our pre-pandemic numbers with audiences. But we've also been fortunate enough to have a lot of support from people in the state, in our area, from our local government representatives, which has been great, and a lot of individual donors, individual families, and our people who believe in the value of having a place like a small professional theater in their town. And so that's been wonderful to see, and really, we're really, really grateful for it.
Well, that's excellent. And so tell me a little bit about the work that Williamston does, like as artistic director, when you're looking to choose a season to serve your community, what kind of stories, what kind of plays do you look for?
Sure. It's funny. It's in some ways it's a mix. We talk all the time about the value of a season being like a good dinner, not too much meat, not too much vegetables, not too much dessert, right? A little mix of everything. But if there's a kind of play that sort of typifies what we do, the majority of our stuff are plays that we always use the phrase, make you laugh, make you cry, and make you want to call the people you love.
I love that. That's great.
And that really is sort of the bread and butter of what we do. You know, theater does a lot of things, and entertain has to be the first one, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And then the rest of the shows are a great mix of things that are heavy drama or a classic or something that's going to be very related to topical issues going on in the world around us. And so trying to have that mix of things, we're in a part of the state, you know, part of the fun of life is that Michigan is a very swing state politically, and Ingham County, where we are, is a very swing county politically. And so we get a ton of varied responses to things, which is fun and a challenge. But I love the fact that if I do two big rip-roaring comedies purely for the bring joy into the world factor, two of them in a row, I'll get messages from people going, these are so great. Are you going to do stuff that's got a little more meat to it? And then if I do the big meaty thing, I'll get people going, oh my God, this is great. And I'll also get a thing going, you're still going to do the comedies, right?
Right. Yeah. So again, it's that dinner plate of drama, right? Dinner plate of theater.
Right. That's exactly it. And I love that mix of things. And you know, because of where we are, having a lot of our patrons come from more rural areas is really great for us. I love being here and being able to be a source of entertainment and enlightenment and a place where questions can be asked and people can feel comfortable being uncomfortable sometimes, you know.
And I think that's the point, too. I mean, listening to you talk about, you know, doing art and telling stories in a swing state and fostering those kinds of conversations, I think not only with audiences and artists, but also between audience members, perhaps. I know that from some of the programming that you sort of have around the shows that you do, I know you have conversations and you have talkbacks and those kinds of things. Is that right?
It is. Yeah, we do a fair amount of those things. We'll do with events called Conversation Sundays, where either the director or the cast or designers will be around for conversations with audience and have a talk back after the show. And sometimes we turn those into, depending on what the topic of the show itself is, we'll turn those into an actual guest speaker and bring in an expert on something, you know, to talk about it. And sometimes it's political issues or social or health issues, and sometimes it's historical issues. And you know, when we did Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol, for instance, we brought in a literature expert from the university to talk about Charles Dickens and Christmas Carol and what, you know, all of the things surrounding that. And there are shows where we've brought in experts on suicide and therapy and family relations and things like that. I think those are important. And then sometimes we'll do a big old comedy and just sit with the audience and chat about the process of making a comedy, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And these are just such great examples of how art can bring a community together, and particularly in a community like where you live and where I live, where, you know, a lot of the conversations, a lot of the political conversations can be fraught or difficult. You know, I'm so heartened by folks that I speak to like you who are using art as ways to bridge differences with people, right? And it seems like we need that a lot more now than maybe we even did before the pandemic.
Yeah, no, I very much agree. And we do talk about that a lot, and it does impact my search for plays, search for productions that we're going to do. And the other founders and the rest of the staff and I talk about that often, because whatever side politically you're on, we should all be able to sit and discuss things, you know? And so a lot of the times, as straightforward as it sounds, just putting something out there that promotes empathy and people being able to go, oh, that's a completely different life than I would ever live. Let's talk about that. As opposed to, oh, that's different for me, I should throw rocks at it and run away, right? I think those are two responses that can happen. And if you just find that way, find those examples, find those reasons to sit in a room together and have an experience together and then talk about it, I think that helps make us all a better people.
I cannot agree more. I cannot agree more, Tony. That's just lovely. You were talking about the ways that you choose your seasons, and I know that you do new work, you do new plays, and that can be, that's often thought of, and I know because I write plays, and I'm often told how risky it is.
Wait a minute. I know.
But it's also, we're told all the time how risky it is to program new work, especially in smaller communities or places where theater going may not be, you know, such a casual experience, right? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I love new plays. That was one of the things that I was blessed to be a part of all the time in the 12 years that I worked at the Purple Rose, and knew that I wanted to do that when we opened Williamston Theater. I think part of it was because I love working on them. I love working with teams of people, those collaborations, and I love working with playwrights and that sense of we're building something that was just didn't exist before, also the idea of just adding to the canon. What are you contributing in the future? What have you left behind after you've run theater? Right. You know, so much of it is ephemeral and ethereal, and that's part of the fun of it. You do a show for a while and then it just goes away. But also being able to say, look, we helped build these things that other artists will take and do their interpretation of for years now is sort of a wonderful thing. But it is a challenge. And because it's a little bit more work than a play that's already established. And so you're right. A lot of times you would hear from people you don't know if people are going to come. New plays just don't sell as well. And in general, we have not found that to be the case. I mean, if you look at the history of Williamston Theater, we just started season 18, but if you go back and look at all of our previous seasons, the best-selling show for around half of those seasons was a brand new world premiere play that had no name recognition. And the fun of that, I think, is pretty great to be able to go, yeah, we have a new thing that nobody's heard of. And then people love it and word of mouth makes them want to come.
Yeah, and I think that's also a data point that we need to keep in mind with a lot of the choices that we make here in the Heartland is you know what? New stories, new plays, things that younger audiences, I mean like audiences that are less experienced and maybe becoming regular theater goers, that, you know, things they haven't heard of, that's great. It's fine. We can totally put these stories out there as long as we, you know, support them and understand what that means, right?
Absolutely. I think if you connect with people and go, yeah, you don't know what this is, but it relates to your life. Come see this. This is funny and heartbreaking or whatever it is. And we're putting it on because it has value. Like, it's going to have an impact. And I think a lot of times people respond to that, especially if they find themselves pulled in. You know, I mean, as a playwright, you know, the cardinal sin in theater is being boring. Don't
Absolutely.
Be boring.
Yes. Don't be boring.
Right? Make them feel something and have a good time. And again, make them want to call their friends and go, have you guys ever heard of this place, this show, this whatever? I love being able to do that. And your play Predictor is a great example of that. Because Predictor is about Meg Crane, who you know, invented the home pregnancy test and then was shoved to the side by corporations and rich white men. It's a story that people should know about our lives and the world around us. And it's told in such a fun, engaging way. You know, I think I shared with you before, when you get audience members coming out of a play they've never heard of going, I have never in the same moment cried and laughed and wanted to punch someone so hard as I did today.
That's great.
I'm like, come on, we're doing something. This is what we're here for, you know.
And that's exactly the reaction I was going for right there. That sort of weird combination of things. I love it.
It's so true.
So you've taken this commitment to new plays even a step or two further, because you've just commissioned a work by a very well-known playwright named Terry Guest. And he had a hit a few years back with this beautiful play called Magnolia Ballet. And now his play Thirst is running at Williamston. Can you talk about what that's about?
It is, yes. We were part of the Rolling World premiere through the National New Play Network a couple of years ago with Terry's beautiful play, Magnolia Ballet Part 1. And it was right around there where here in Michigan, because we're one of the Great Lakes states, and at that time there were a bunch of news articles that were just coming at me and kept bouncing into my sort of consciousness about like the Nestle Corporation just coming in and taking all of the Great Lakes and bottling it and selling it. And other states out west saying, we are having droughts and we want to talk about building a pipeline to the Great Lakes to get some of that. And, you know, the Great Lakes states having reactions to that. And talking with a good friend of mine who lives in New Orleans and with all of the water trouble they have there. And so I went to Terry and I said, would you be interested in a commission? I want a play about water rights and human rights and late stage capitalism. And it can't
all the
be
big things, right? All the big things.
Right. And he said, yeah, I want to do that. And, you know, and we agreed that it couldn't just be a TED talk, which nothing wrong with those, but that's not what you go to theater for.
Right.
And Terry is a fabulous queer Black playwright from the South who has played the Magnolia Ballet Part One is about a young boy growing up queer and Black in the South. And he said to me, I want to do this commission. I want to write this play, but I also have to write about my people too. Mm-hmm. And I said, of course, you have to write what you want to write. I wanted to involve these things. What can that mean? And so over the course of 2 years, it took him several months before we got a first draft and we'd had, you know, kept having discussions about it. And then we had a reading of that and did a workshop and a couple other readings and things like that and kept polishing it. And then, I mean, it's amazing what happens in all y'all writer brains because what we got was this fabulous futuristic taking place about 25 years from now after the Great Lakes have been destroyed by an oil spill and the world has just gotten worse because 25 years from now, climate change and all of that has gotten exponentially worse and the world has turned a little more Hunger Games-y and the separation between the haves and the have-nots is much worse and it turns into a murder mystery thriller plot where the rich people who actually can have fresh water and everybody else who have to live with these new hydration tablets that the government has come up with have almost nothing in common. But one of them, one of the rich people hires a woman to try and help murder his wife.
Oh, wow.
And it becomes this very darkly comic, bothersome murder mystery play about power and class issues and race issues and water issues. That's very personal and very, very moving and bothersome. And so far, audiences here in Michigan have loved it. And I think Terry just did a great job of blending all of those things together into this crazy package that, again, is a new play that nobody's ever heard of.
Right. And that's what happens. I mean, when you bring a writer in and say, here, we're going to give you some support to do this new thing, you never know what amazing thing you're going to get. That's awesome.
It is. And it's part of the risk. And, you know, you go into it going, we could get a 30 character thing that we'll never be able to do. And, you know, you try and steer them toward like, at least make it something we can do, you know,
yeah.
But it turned into this fabulous thing that we've had a great time producing. And it's been a technical challenge for us. It's, you know, as a small professional theater company, it's got a bunch of running water stuff in it and a big water fountain in the middle of the set. It's a magical little fable about how do we treat each other and how do we treat the world around us and, you know.
Well, it sounds lovely, and to create the space for that is truly an incredible endeavor on your part with your company. I think that just the focus that you all have on your community and the work that you do, not only for Williamston, but also I think the Lansing area is just so moving to me. And the fact that you believe in your audiences and you trust them to really be a partner with you. Tony, I want to thank you for your time today to connect with us here in East Central Indiana and remind us that there are just communities all over the heartland who are doing some incredible work in professional theater and storytelling.
Thank you. And I really appreciate it because just what you said is so true. Sometimes just those connections with each other outside of states to go, oh, you're not alone in this. Sometimes just that is so refreshing and inspiring. And so thanks for the great interview and the great show that you guys are doing.
You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. It's time to ask another artist, what are you working on?
Our co-host, Kara Duquette, has this one.
We are here today with Juniper Kuntz. And I'm wondering, Juniper, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to the arts and specifically dance?
Yeah, so I'm Juniper Kuntz. I grew up in Delaware County. At age 2, I started dancing. I loved going to dance performances. Growing up, it was like the only thing I would sit still for. I was just very fascinated by it. So my parents put me in dance classes at age 2 and just kind of grew from there. And along my journey through life, I started developing passions for other artistic outlets as well, especially writing and acting. Really just helps me find who I am and help me express inward things outwardly.
I'm wondering, do you work on these different expressions of art simultaneously, or how does that work for you?
I think I understand what you're asking. So I love to create original stories or original pieces by writing them and putting them into theatrical form, whether it's through dance or acting or both.
Oh, that's super interesting. Could you share with us a little vignette of something you've written, possibly?
Yeah. So recently, I was a part of this OD awareness event that was on August 31st in Madison County. And someone else actually came up with this story, but it was me and a group of people that someone from Muncie Civic created. It was our job to put it together to make the story alive for an audience. And that was just such a great experience because we all had different experiences, whether it was in theater or dancing. Or one guy, he didn't really have much artistic experience, but we still made it work. And so putting that together, because I have such a passion for creating original work, I don't like doing things that have been done before. And so sometimes that will get in the way of trying to create things. It gets hard sometimes because, you know, you don't want to create something that's already been done, but you also want to get across to the audience what you're trying to get across. You don't want it to be too confusing. And so trying to find that balance in that situation was very difficult, especially because we were on a time crunch. We had like 2 weeks to put it together. But we made it work, and it turned out super beautiful.
So you performed it in
yes.
front of a group?
Yeah.
Okay, and it was like dancing and spoken?
It was dancing and acting. We didn't add words. We thought about it, but we decided not to. So it was mostly dancing, acting, interpretive movement, that kind of thing.
That's pretty amazing to think about how you can express something through the arts without the narrative, you know, and just so many ways that you can, you know, connect with people about similar things that people go through.
Yes.
Know? Whether it's drugs or just having a family or.
Mm-hmm. It was such a different experience finally getting to share that to an audience, especially because I related so much to the character I was portraying. And so it was so cool to bring that to life in an artistic aspect.
Well, when you talk about bringing things to life artistically, I know that you're a dancer, and I'm wondering if there's a particular type of dance that you is your favorite or?
I really like contemporary and hip-hop. Contemporary and hip-hop, they're so flexible. A lot of people, when I say hip-hop, they think of like street dancers or, you know what I mean? So it's like, but hip-hop in itself, it was just created like honestly, it just means whoever you are, display that on the outside.
So do you choreograph hip hop dances?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How does that work? Like, is it free Ooh. Flow or is it like?
What do you mean by free flow?
Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, do you create, like, a hip-hop moment and then you recreate it again? Or is it, like, this renewal of who you are in the moment? Like,
ooh. Yeah, I mean, it definitely depends on how I'm doing in that moment. Right now, I mostly choreograph hip-hop for the classes that I teach. Because I teach at... forgot to mention that I teach at Cornerstone and an elementary school's Latchkey program, which is like an after-school program, and then I also teach at Civic. And so when I put my whole self into a dance to teach to others, it's not only expressing who I am, it's also giving them an opportunity to explore that side of themselves. So whatever the vibe, aesthetic, whatever you want to call it, of the combo is, it's nice to watch how other people interpret that, because it might not be the same as how I interpret it, especially using different songs. It's like how I interpret the lyrics, someone may interpret it totally different, or how I feel the movement, someone may feel that totally different. And so it's the same choreography, but it looks so much different. And it's so interesting to see like how I feel like also displayed through someone else and seeing how they feel that.
That's pretty amazing. I like hearing about that. Dance is not something that I've done much of my life, so it's really interesting to like hear about how it moves through you. Is there any place we can see you online? Do you have an online presence with your art at all? Or
I have been wanting to create different social media pages, like specifically just for my art. I'm like an extrovert, but at the same time, like when it comes to social media stuff, I'm kind of shy.
I totally get that.
And so I'm trying to start posting more because I don't just dance. Like I do a lot of stuff, and a lot of people don't know about that because people just viewed me as the girl who dances my whole life. And so it would be nice to display my different kinds of art on social media.
Yeah, to just share. I understand the desire to put things out there and then sometimes going, I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, if you want to follow me on social media, come through me with this journey of sharing my art. It's literally just my name, Juniper Koontz. Koontz is K-O-O-N-T-Z.
And is there anything else you'd like to tell us today?
Sure. I just want to like let people know if you have thought about getting into anything artistic, or you already are, I keep going, keep self-discovering through it, because it is such, like, honestly, it saved my life. There is so much creativity sparks so much self-discovery, and it allows you to display your needs and desires and your passions and your experiences to the outside world, especially if you struggle with using your voice.
Well, thank you, Juniper. That's super inspiring and like really important for people to think about. Thank you for being here with us today.
Of course. Thank you.
Okay, Jen, it is time for the Pop of Culture calendar. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right, I'll kick it off. Saturday, October 19th, Minnetrista Museum and Gardens will have its Boulevard Bash. Guests can walk along historic Minnetrista Boulevard collecting treats from the Ball family homes, including the wooded path of Oakhurst Gardens. There will also be photo spots, games and activities for the whole family. So much to do. Family-friendly costumes are encouraged.
Boulevard.
I love saying that.
This is also your last weekend to catch Muncie Civic Theater's production of The Great Gatsby on the main stage. For tickets and more info, go to MuncieCivic.org.
Ball State's Department of Theater and Dance is presenting Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again at Strother Theater through October 27th. Playwright Alice Birch has put together a grouping of vignettes that ask how to revolutionize language, relationships, work, and life in general while bursting at the seams of conformity. For performance times and more, go to bsu.edu/calendar.
And Michelle, we should probably let our listeners know that Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again is for mature audiences.
Good to know.
Yes, 18 and up.
So not for the whole family, this one.
Not this one. The Heartland Film Festival runs through Sunday, October 20th in Indianapolis. This festival has grown from a four-day event with fewer than 20 films to what it is now, an 11-day celebration that typically showcases more than 300 feature film screenings and more than 200 filmmakers.
That's awesome.
I know. Yes.
Right,
I remember when
Indiana.
It started, and yes. This is incredible.
Unbelievable.
So definitely check that out.
Yes. Paramount Theater in Anderson is presenting the film Nosferatu with live accompaniment on the page organ. That'll be Saturday, October 19th at 7:30 p.m. The original vampire movie, The Silent Film, will be accompanied by Clark Wilson of the famed Ohio Theater. AndersonParamount.org is the place to go for more info.
Ball State University's Emmons Auditorium will be transformed into Hadestown Tuesday, October 22nd, as part of the venue's artist series. The Broadway, Tony, and Grammy Award-winning Best Musical from celebrated singer-songwriter Anais Mitchell and innovative director Rachel Chavkin intertwines two mythic tales, that of young dreamers Orpheus and Eurydice, and that of King Hades and his wife Persephone. It's a love story for today and always. bsu.edu/Emmons is the place to go for tickets. I can't wait.
So excited for that one. Very excited. If you have a love story or an event Pop of Culture listeners should know about, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who is celebrating his one-year anniversary at IPR and Pop of Culture Town. Our show was hosted by me, Jen Blackmer.
And me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.